Hello, and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1. Physical, emotional, behavioral, and neurocognitive developmental outcomes from 2 to 4 years after PICU admission. A secondary analysis of the early versus late parenteral nutrition randomized control trial cohort by Verlinden et al. Objectives. PICU patients face long-term developmental impairments, partially attributable to early parenteral nutrition versus late parenteral nutrition. We investigated how this legacy and harm by early parenteral nutrition evolve over time. Design. This was a pre-planned secondary analysis of the multicenter PEPINIC, or Early versus Late Parenteral Nutrition in the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit, randomized control trial that enrolled 1,440 critically ill children from 2012 to 2015 and its 2 and 4 year cross-sectional follow-up studies. Setting, PICUs of Leuven, Belgium, Rotterdam, the Netherlands, and Edmonton, Canada. Patients included patients and demographically matched healthy control children that underwent longitudinal assessment for physical, emotional, behavioral, and neurocognitive functions at both follow-up time points. Interventions. In the PEPINIC randomized control trial, patients were randomly allocated to early parenteral nutrition versus late parenteral nutrition. Measurements and main results. This within-individual longitudinal study investigated changes in physical, emotional, behavioral, and neurocognitive functions from 2 to 4 years after PICU admission for 614 patients, including 297 patients who received early parenteral nutrition tested at a mean age of 5.4 years, plus or minus a standard deviation of 4.2 years, and 317 patients who received late parenteral nutrition tested at a mean age of 7.3 years, plus or minus a standard deviation of 4.3 years, and for 357 demographically matched healthy children tested at a mean age of 5.6 years with a standard deviation plus or minus 4.3 years, and 7.5 years with a standard deviation plus or minus 4.3 years, respectively. We determined within group time courses, interaction between time and group, and independent impact of critical illness and early parenteral nutrition on these time courses. Most deficits in patients versus healthy children remained prominent over the 2 years with a p-value less than or equal to 0.01. Deficits further aggravated for height, body mass index, the executive function metacognition, intelligence, motor coordination including alternating and synchronous tapping, and memory learning index, whereas verbal memory deficits became smaller, including working, immediate, and delayed memory, with a p-value of less than or equal to 0.05. Adjustment for risk factors confirmed most findings and revealed that patients grew into deficit for additional executive functions, including flexibility, emotional control, and total executive functioning, and grew out of deficit for additional memory functions, including recognition and pictures, with a p-value of less than or equal to 0.05. Time courses were largely unaffected by early parenteral nutrition versus late parenteral nutrition, except for weight loss and limited catch-up for visual motor integration and alertness in early parenteral nutrition patients, with a p-value of less than or equal to 0.05. Conclusions. From 2 to 4 years post-PICU admission, developmental impairments remained prominent. Within that time window, impaired growth in height, executive functioning, and intelligence aggravated, and impaired memory and harm by early parenteral nutrition only partially recovered. Impact on development into adulthood requires further investigation. Abstract 2. Outcomes associated with timing of neurologic dysfunction onset relative to pediatric sepsis recognition by Alcamo et al. Objectives. To compare outcomes associated with timing, early versus late, of any neurologic dysfunction during pediatric sepsis. Design. Secondary analysis of a cross-sectional point prevalence study. Setting. A total of 128 PICUs in 26 countries. Patients. Less than 18 years old with severe sepsis on 5 separate days from 2013 to 2014. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Patients were categorized as having either no neurologic dysfunction or neurologic dysfunction, in other words, present at or after sepsis recognition, which was defined as Glasgow Coma Scale score less than 5 and/or fixed and dilated pupils.
Our primary outcome was death or new moderate disability, in other words, pediatric overall or cerebral performance category score greater than or equal to 3 and change greater than or equal to 1 from baseline at hospital discharge, and 87 of 567 severe sepsis patients, or 15%, had neurologic dysfunction within 7 days of sepsis recognition. 61 were at sepsis recognition, and 26 were after sepsis recognition. Primary site of infection varied based on presence of neurologic dysfunction. Death or new moderate disability occurred in 161 of 480, or 34%, without neurologic dysfunction, 45 of 61, or 74%, with neurologic dysfunction at sepsis recognition, and 21 of 26, or 81%, with neurologic dysfunction after sepsis recognition, with a p-value less than 0.001 across all groups. On multivariable analysis, in comparison with those without neurologic dysfunction, whether at sepsis recognition or after, was associated with increased odds of death with an adjusted odds ratio of 4.9 and a 95% confidence interval of 2.3 to 10.1, or new moderate disability with an adjusted odds ratio of 10.7 and a 95% confidence interval of 3.8 to 30.5. We failed to identify a difference between these adjusted odds ratios of death or new moderate disability that would indicate a differential risk of outcome based on timing of neurologic dysfunction, with a p-value of 0.2. Conclusions. In this severe sepsis international cohort, the presence of neurologic dysfunction during sepsis is associated with worse outcomes at hospital discharge. The impact of early versus late onset of neurologic dysfunction in sepsis on outcome remains unknown, and further work is needed to better understand timing of neurologic dysfunction onset in pediatric sepsis. Abstract 3. Geospatial analysis of social determinants of health identifies neighborhood hotspots associated with pediatric intensive care use for acute respiratory failure requiring mechanical ventilation, by Najjar et al. Objectives. Poverty, racial bias, and disparities are linked to adverse health outcomes for children in the United States. The social vulnerability and child opportunity indices are composite measures of the social, economic, education, health, and environmental qualities that affect human health for every U.S. Census tract. Composite measures of social vulnerability and child opportunity were compared for neighborhood hotspots, where PICU admissions for acute respiratory failure requiring invasive mechanical ventilation were at the 90th percentile or greater per 1,000 children versus non-hotspots. Design, population-based ecological study. Setting, two urban freestanding children's hospital PICUs consisting of a 36-bed quaternary academic and a 56-bed tertiary community center in Atlanta, Georgia. Patients, mechanically ventilated children who were 17 years of age or younger with a geocodable Georgia residential address admitted to a PICU for at least 1 day. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Residential addresses were geocoded and spatially joined to census tracts. Composite measures of social vulnerability and childhood opportunity, PICU readmission rates, and hospital length of stay were compared between neighborhood hotspots versus non-hotspots. There were 340 of 3,514 children, or 9.7%, who lived within a hotspot. Hotspots were associated with a higher or worse composite social vulnerability index ranking, reflecting differences in socioeconomic status, household composition and disability, and housing type and transportation. Hotspots also had a lower or worse composite childhood opportunity index percentile ranking, reflecting differences in the education, health and environment, and social and economic domains. Higher social vulnerability and lower childhood opportunity were not associated with readmission rates, but were associated with longer total median duration of hospital days per 1,000 children in a census tract. Conclusions. Social determinants of health identified by geospatial analyses are associated with acute respiratory failure requiring invasive mechanical ventilation in critically ill children. Interventions addressing the neighborhood social vulnerability and child opportunity are needed to decrease disparities in intensive care admissions for acute respiratory failure requiring mechanical ventilation. Abstract 4, Peripheral Vasoactive Administration in Critically Ill Children with Shock, a Single Center Retrospective Cohort Study, by Levy et al. Objectives. Management of fluid refractory pediatric shock requires prompt administration of vasoactive agents. Although delivery of vasoactive therapy is generally provided via a central venous catheter, their placement can delay drug administration and is associated with complications. We characterized peripheral vasoactive administration in a cohort of critically ill children with shock, evaluate progression to central venous catheter placement, and describe complications associated with extravasation. Design, retrospective cohort study. Setting, single center quaternary PICU from January 2010 to December 2015. Patients, children 31 days old to 18 years old who received epinephrine, norepinephrine, or dopamine. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We compared patients based on the initial site of vasoactive infusion, peripheral venous access or central venous access, and within the peripheral venous access group, compared patients based on subsequent placement of a central catheter for vasoactive infusion. We also characterized peripheral extravasations. We evaluated 756 patients, including 231 or 30.6% peripheral venous access and 525 or 69.4% central venous access patients. Peripheral venous access patients were older, had lower illness severity, and more frequently had vasoactive therapy initiated at night compared with central venous access patients. In peripheral venous access patients, 124 or 53.7% had a central catheter placed after a median of 140 minutes with an interquartile range of 65 to 247 minutes of peripheral treatment. Patients who avoided central catheter placement had lower illness severity. Of the 93 patients with septic shock, 44 or 47.3% did not have a central catheter placed. Extravasations occurred in 4 of 231 or 1.7% of peripheral venous access patients, exclusively in the hand, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.03 to 3.4. Three patients received pharmacologic intervention and none had long-term disabilities. Conclusions. In our experience, peripheral venous catheters can be used for vasoactive administration. In our series, the upper limit of the 95% confidence interval for extravasation is approximately 1 in 30, meaning that this route may be an appropriate option while evaluating the need for central access, particularly in patients with low illness severity. Abstract 5, peripheral and central or intraosseous vasoactive infusions during and after pediatric critical care transport, a retrospective cohort study of extravasation injury, by Pershimam et al. Objectives, to compare the prevalence of adverse events related to vasoactive drug infusions administered via a peripheral venous catheter versus a central venous or intraosseous catheter. Design, retrospective observational study. Setting, a pediatric critical care transport team and the PICUs and regional hospitals within the North Thames and East Anglia regions of the United Kingdom. Patients, children up to 18 years old transported by the Children's Acute Transport Service receiving an infusion of a vasoactive drug, including epinephrine, dobutamine, dopamine, norepinephrine, and vasopressin. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The medical records of all children transported between April 2017 and May 2020 receiving a vasoactive drug infusion were reviewed and cross-referenced with the Service Critical Incident Database. The outcome measure was anatomic catheter-related adverse events, including extravasation reported during transport or in the first 24 hours in the PICU. During the study period, the service undertook 3,836 transports. Vasoactive drugs were administered during 558 patient transports, or 14.5%. During 198 of 558 transports, or 35.5%, vasoactive drugs were administered via a peripheral venous catheter, with 7 of 198 adverse events, or 3.5%. One extravasation event resulted in tissue necrosis. The median time to injury after the infusion was commenced was 60 minutes, with an interquartile range of 30 to 60 minutes. During 360 of 558 transports, or 64.5%, vasoactive infusions were administered by central venous or intraosseous catheter, with 9 of 360 adverse events, or 2.5%. Conclusions. During pediatric critical care transport, we did not find a difference in prevalence of adverse events following the administration of vasoactive drugs via peripheral venous catheters or via central venous and intraosseous catheters. Abstract 6, Association of Pathogen Type with Outcomes of Children Encountering Community-Acquired Pediatric Septic Shock, by Salud et al. The objectives were to determine the association of pathogen type with mortality, functional status, and health-related quality of life among children at hospital discharge or 1 month, whichever came first, following hospitalization for septic shock. The design was a secondary database analysis of a prospective descriptive cohort investigation. The setting included 12 academic PICUs in the United States. Patients were critically ill children 1 month to 18 years old enrolled from 2013 to 2017. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Association of clinical outcomes with pathogen type was assessed for all patients and separately for surviving patients enrolled in the primary Life After Pediatric Sepsis Evaluation or LAPS investigation. For this secondary analysis, we predicted that age would be associated with pathogen type and outcomes, and accordingly, it was incorporated as a confounding variable in primary analyses. Among 389 children enrolled with septic shock, at 1 month or hospital discharge, whichever came first, we observed no statistically significant differences in relation to pathogen types for the composite outcome mortality or substantial new functional morbidity. 28 of 103, or 27%, had no causative organism identified. 24 of 91, or 26%, had pure viral infections. 31 of 125, or 25%, had pure bacterial or fungal infections. And 23 of 70, or 33%, had bacterial or fungal plus a viral co-infection. Similarly, we observed no statistically significant differences in relation to pathogen types for the composite outcome, mortality, or persistent serious deterioration of health-related quality of life. 44 of 103, or 43%, had no causative organism identified. 30 of 91, or 33%, had pure viral infections. 57 of 125, or 46%, had pure bacterial or fungal infections. And 30 of 70, or 43%, had bacterial or fungal plus a viral co-infection. However, we did identify statistically significant associations between pathogen type and the outcome ventilator-free days, with a p-value equal to 0.0083, and pathogen type and PICU-free days, with a p-value of 0.0238. In conclusion, this secondary analysis of the LAPS database identified no statistically significant association of pathogen type with composite mortality and morbidity outcomes. However, pathogen type may be associated with PICU resources employed to treat sepsis organ dysfunction. Ultimately, pediatric septic shock was frequently associated with adverse patient-centered clinically meaningful outcomes regardless of infectious disease pathogen type. Abstract 7. Variations in Demonstrated Emotional Intelligence, Trainee to Experienced Faculty Member, by Lascalzo et al. The objectives were to identify differences in emotional intelligence-related competencies between fellows and faculty in a cohort of pediatric critical care physicians. The design was a single-center, cross-sectional observational study. The setting was a 72-bed multidisciplinary pediatric critical care unit at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, a quaternary children's hospital. Subjects: 47 critical care physicians, including 19 fellows and 28 faculty members, were assessed. A multidisciplinary team of 83 physicians, nurses, and nurse practitioners contributed to the assessments. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. A multi-rater emotional intelligence assessment tool, the Emotional and Social Competency Inventory 360, was used to measure emotional intelligence competencies of participating physicians across 12 core competencies. Utilizing a priori scoring definitions, physician emotional intelligence competencies were classified as strengths or areas for growth. Results were stratified based on provider experience, generating comparisons between fellow and faculty cohorts. 177 of 188, or 94%, of distributed assessments were completed. Fellow strengths were identified as organization awareness, achievement orientation, and teamwork. Areas for growth were influence and emotional self-awareness. Compared with fellows, faculty members demonstrated additional strengths in the domains of adaptability, emotional self-control, coach and mentor, positive outlook, inspirational leadership, and influence. In conclusion, this study provides the first characterization of emotional intelligence competencies among trainees and faculty members using a validated multi-rater assessment tool. The descriptions of physician emotional intelligence based on years of experience are an important piece of the foundation for future explorations into the advancement of physician emotional intelligence and effective leadership. Abstract 8. Comparison of laboratory and hemodynamic time series data across original, alpha, and delta variants in patients with multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, by Jane et al. Objectives: to compare the clinical, laboratory, and hemodynamic parameters during hospitalization for patients with multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, MISC, across the original alpha and delta variants of severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 infection. The design was a retrospective cohort study. The setting was a single-center quaternary children's hospital. Patients included children with MISC admitted from May 2020 to February 2021, which was the original and alpha variant cohort, and August 2021 to November 2021, which was the delta variant cohort. Measurements and main results: continuous vital sign measurements, laboratory results, medications data, and hospital outcomes from all subjects were evaluated. There were 134 patients, including 102 with original or alpha and 32 with delta. The median age was 9 years old, 75 or 56% were male, and 61 or 46% were Hispanic. The cohort with original or alpha variant had more males, 61% versus 41%, and a p-value of 0.036, and more respiratory and musculoskeletal symptoms on presentation compared with the delta variant, with a p-value of less than 0.05. More patients in the original or alpha variant cohort received mechanical ventilation, 16 versus 0, and a p-value of 0.009. Median hospital length of stay was 7 days, and ICU length of stay was 3 days for the entire cohort. ICU length of stay was shorter in the cohort with the delta variant compared with the original or alpha variant, 4 days versus 2 days, and a p-value of 0.001. Only one patient had cardiac arrest, 2 needed extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, and 2 needed left ventricular assist devices, all in the original or alpha variant cohort. No mortality occurred in the entire cohort. The MISC cohort associated with the delta variant had lower median lab values, including INR, prothrombin time, white blood cell count, sodium, phosphorus, and potassium during hospitalization compared with the original or alpha variants, with a p-value of less than 0.05. Hemodynamic assessment showed significant tachycardia in the original or alpha variant cohort compared with the delta variant cohort, with a p-value of less than 0.05. In conclusion, patients with MISC associated with the delta variants had lower severity during hospitalization compared with the original or alpha variant. Analysis of distinct trends in clinical and laboratory parameters with future variants of concern will allow for potential modification of treatment protocol. Abstract 9, Transcranial Doppler Ultrasonography in Children with Acute Liver Failure and Severe Hepatic Encephalopathy, by Cousin et al. The objectives were to report single-center use of transcranial Doppler for non-invasive neuromonitoring in pediatric patients with acute liver failure. The design was a retrospective cohort study from January 2016 to June 2019. The setting was a PICU in Bicêtre Hospital, Assistance Publique Hôpital de Paris, a national referral center for pediatric liver transplantation. Patients included pediatric patients with severe acute liver failure, including prothrombin time less than 30% and hepatic encephalopathy score greater than or equal to 3, who were on continuous veno-venous high-flow hemofiltration. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: 10 children were identified. 6 were transplanted, 1 of those 6 died, and 4 were not, 3 of those 4 died. Transcranial Doppler was performed several times per patient, and the evolution of cerebral perfusion parameters was followed. Of interest, 0 of 6 patients who survived lost end-diastolic velocity, whereas 4 of 4 patients who died did lose end-diastolic velocity. The difference was 100%, with a 95% confidence interval of 37 to 100%. Chi-square was 9, there was 1 degree of freedom, p-value equals 0.0027. They failed to identify an association between pulsatility index or end-diastolic velocity and severity of hepatic encephalopathy. In conclusion, transcranial Doppler was a non-invasive and bedside available tool to detect and screen for presence of abnormal cerebral flow in children with acute liver failure according to age-related reference values. Transcranial Doppler detected reduced end-diastolic velocity and elevated pulsatility index in children with acute liver failure awaiting transplant who died compared with those who survived. Abstract 10, Polymixin B Hemoperfusion in Pediatric Septic Shock, a Single-Center Observational Case Series, by Seitong et al. The objective was to evaluate the use of direct hemoperfusion with polymixin B immobilized fiber as adjunctive therapy in pediatric patients with septic shock. The design was a prospective observational study. The setting was a 9-bed PICU at a university referral hospital. Patients included children aged 30 days to 15 years old with septic shock and pediatric logistic organ dysfunction or PLOD 2 score greater than or equal to 10, or pediatric risk of mortality or PRISM 3 score greater than or equal to 15, who were also receiving at least one inotrope. Intervention. The patients received a 2 to 4 hour treatment with polymyxin B immobilized fiber on 2 consecutive days. Measurements and main results. We enrolled 6 children aged 21 to 167 months old. Median age was 99 months old or 8.25 years, with a body weight of 10 to 50 kilograms, median weight 28 kilograms. All 6 patients had both PLOD 2 scores greater than or equal to 10 and PRISM 3 scores greater than or equal to 15, required invasive mechanical ventilation, and received standard treatment for septic shock before enrollment. We observed significant improvement in PLOD 2 scores from baseline to 72 hours after the start of polymyxin B immobilized fiber. The mean initial PLOD 2 score went from 14.3 with a 95% confidence interval of 12.2 to 16.5 down to 6.0 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.3 to 11.7 and a p-value of 0.006. The vasoactive inotropic score and lactate concentration also significantly decreased from baseline to 72 hours. The vasoactive inotropic score decreased from 60 millimoles per liter with a 95% confidence interval of 25 to 95 millimoles per liter down to 4 millimoles per liter with a 95% confidence interval of 4 to 12 millimoles per liter and a p-value of 0.003, and the lactate decreased from 2.4 millimoles per liter with a 95% confidence interval of 1 to 3.8 millimoles per liter down to 1 millimole per liter with a 95% confidence interval of 0.5 to 1.5 millimoles per liter and a p-value of 0.01. 5 of 6 patients survived. There was no device-related adverse event in these patients. Conclusions. In this case series of treatment with polymyxin B immobilized fiber as adjunctive therapy in children with refractory septic shock and high baseline severity, we have shown that patient recruitment is feasible. We have also found that clinical hemodynamic and severity of illness scores at 72 hours may be potential endpoints for testing in future randomized controlled trials. Abstract 11, Clinical Decision Support in the PICU, Implications for Design and Evaluation, by Zorni et al. The objectives were to assess the current landscape of clinical decision support tools in PICUs in order to identify priority areas of focus in this field. The design was an international quantitative cross-sectional survey. The subjects included medical directors, bedside nurses, attending physicians, residents, and advanced practice providers at pediatric acute lung injury and sepsis investigators, or PLICI, network-affiliated PICUs. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The survey was completed by 109 respondents from 45 institutions, primarily attending physicians from university-affiliated PICUs in the United States. The most commonly used clinical decision support tools were people-based resources. 93% used always or most of the time, and laboratory result highlighting. 86% used always or most of the time, with order sets, order-based alerts, and other electronic clinical decision support tools also used frequently. The most important goal providers endorsed for clinical decision support tools were a proven impact on patient safety and an evidence base for their use. Negative perceptions of clinical decision support tools included concerns about diminished critical thinking and the burden of intrusive processes on providers. Routine assessment of existing clinical decision support tools was rare, with infrequent reported use of observation to assess clinical decision support tool impact on workflows or measures of individual alert burden. Conclusions. Although providers share some consensus over clinical decision support tool utility, we identified specific priority areas of research focus. Consensus across practitioners exists around the importance of evidence-based clinical decision support tools having a proven impact on patient safety. Despite broad presence of clinical decision support tools in PICUs, practitioners continue to view them as intrusive and with concern for diminished critical thinking. De-implementing ineffective clinical decision support tools may mitigate this burden, though post-implementation evaluation of clinical decision support tools is rare. This concludes the abstracts for the August 2022 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org.
Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal,